Alright, once more from the beginning, as Plato would say. We start with our prayer. O Holy Creator of life, you are the source of love and inspiration to all. Your infinite peace and grace are constant blessings, even though my attention is often directed away from them by ordinary events. I yearn to know and experience more of your love and light so that I may create a closer bond with you. I call on you now to enfold me in your gentle power and love. So be it. Okay, for our first session today, we of course, start off every day with discussion. Our president is fond of using the phrase, I am my brother's keeper, to justify his socialist proposals. What is the meaning of this phrase?
Well, it traces its roots back to Cain and Abel in the Bible.
If
that's not what you're asking,
really. Well, I'm asking that, yes. It is based on the story of Cain and Abel. What does it mean in that context? Meaning?
Because Cain's trying to divorce himself from the whole thing. And it's his way of shrugging things off.
Okay. So he's saying, in essence, how should I know?
Right.
So is Obama saying that with all these difficult problems, how should I know?
No, he's saying the opposite. With all these difficult problems, he wants to have his nose in all your business. Or he wants the government to have its nose in all of your business.
In other words, he seems to subscribe to the nonsense that it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah, he wants to be your keeper. He doesn't think you can keep yourself.
Right, okay. Is, Right. Is there any other term for this phrase? Does it come from anywhere other than the story of Genesis?
Well, it seems to me that he doesn't know what the phrase means. He never went back to the roots.
Right. He doesn't know what the phrase means.
That is, he shouldn't be using.
How do you suppose that occurred?
Probably his preacher.
Right.
Taught him.
It's probably something he heard Jeremiah Wright ranting about. And he just parrots it like all dutiful liberals parrot what they hear. So is this a Christian principle? Is it a Judeo principle? Is it a principle at all? He claims it's a principle.
It may be a socialist principle.
There you go.
Is that an oxymoron?
He may have a different definition of brother when he says it.
Well, that's probably true, too, but, you know, I think we have discovered from reading David Mamet that the phrase socialist principle is an oxymoron. Socialists or leftists or atheists, in reality, if not by profession. And so how can an atheist quote a biblical expression other than with malice aforethought?
Well, but again, it's like how so many words have been destroyed and now mean the opposite of what they actually really mean.
Okay.
They've taken this phrase, which means one thing, and have twisted it to mean something else.
Exactly. I'm just, the exact opposite.
The exact opposite. I'm always just astounded when I hear somebody use that phrase, and I wonder, do they not know that God is asking this guy, well, why did you kill your brother?
Yeah. Somebody add something?
I was just thinking, perhaps could that be like, where does the responsibility lie? Where does responsibility lie? So it's another way of asking that question. Part of that is, am I my brother's keeper, or where does my responsibility lie?
Do you think that he's asking that sincerely?
No, I'm thinking that. No, I think he's trying to avoid.
Okay. All right. Now, God knows, and we know God knows,
that killed his brother.
Cain has already killed Abel at this point, and that Cain knows exactly where Abel's body lies. So, we can safely say that in this instance, the sinner, by making this statement, the sin of murder is being compounded by the sin of lying. Because not only does he say, am I my brother's keeper? Before that he says, I do not know, am I my brother's keeper? That's the actual quote. I do not know, am I my brother's keeper? And so to turn the sentence around and say, in essence, you do know and you are your brother's keeper is to presume more knowledge than God. And this is one of the problems of liberalism is that, and statism, is it presumes more knowledge than God. It presumes to know how to run healthcare. It presumes to know more about processing chicken and beef than the processors. It presumes to know more about farming than the farmers. It presumes to know more about teaching than the teachers. It presumes to know more about God knows everything than the people, the experts, the people who are daily. It presumes to know more about finance than the Wall Street. It presumes to know more about any subject you want to, aerospace, everything. And this is the sin of hubris, or hebrus, depending on how you pronounce it. Rose. The part that is not quoted is in this story usually is what God continues to say. He says, what have you done? Listen to the sound of your brother's blood crying out to me from the ground. Be accursed, driven from the ground that has opened its mouth. I'll repeat that. What have you done? Listen to the sound of your brother's blood crying out to me from the ground. Be accursed, driven from the ground that has opened its mouth. So he's saying, even the ground tells me, Abel's over here, he's dead. Cain killed him. The very ground you left them on, the ground you farm. And so I'm driving you, you're now accursed by your own action. This is, your own actions have cursed you, and so you must be driven from this ground because the ground knows the truth. So is not Obama's interpretation of this phrase a rather sentimental one that emphasizes cupidity rather than divine law? Is he not glorifying a loophole in divine law? Of course, there are no loopholes in divine law, but he's pretending to invent one. You tell me.
Obama doesn't know what he's talking about, obviously, because he, like most everything else, he just says anything he wants to, because he's in love with the sound of his own words.
Okay, now, in all fairness, in this discussion, we should stipulate that Obama has, as was suggested, Obama's heard this from Jeremiah Ryder somewhere, and there are quasi-religious cults that talk about we are our brother's keeper. They're all socialist organizations, but they are trying to deny one of the very first statements of authority coming from God. Yes, Rose.
Well, when somebody, you know, uses that phrase, I've never heard anybody challenge them as to what do you think that means?
Do you know where
that came from? Yeah. Do you know the full context?
Well, you've heard me challenge.
No, I'm saying that you would ask this person those questions because it has gotten so twisted that they probably don't know.
Well, you know the answer to that.
Or they don't want to know.
You know the answer to that is, it doesn't matter. Yeah. This is the way I'm using it.
Yeah, right.
Well, of course, the...
Well, you still ought to let them know the full context.
Yeah. Well...
And then if they want to continue to misuse it...
So one of the major problems of communication today is quoting out of context.
Yes.
Not describing the full context, not... How can any be
picking and choosing what
how
you
can mean. Any argument be balanced unless you explain the full context? Mm-hmm. Other comments, please.
Carl, I'm wondering, you had said, is it any place else? Is this phrase mentioned any place else in the Bible? I don't know.
I couldn't find anything. Now, maybe some of you know of a passage that I don't know. I think it may be referred to, but I couldn't find that. I searched that. I Googled it.
And it's interesting that it doesn't come from God. It doesn't come
right.
from, you know.
It's not a statement that was made by God. Therefore, you're not going to get Christ, I don't think, quoting it. Because... Now, you might get a theologian somewhere along the line quoting it, forgetting that it's not God, it's Cain defensively trying to excuse himself. But this is, the reason why I picked this is a seminal kind of story, kind of like Sisyphus rolling the boulder up to the top of the hill, and every day it rolls back down upon him and crushes him. And then he gets to do it all over again. This is a seminal story in that it is a story of God's authority being challenged by a human being with blood on his hands. This is the first murder, the first slaying, and as I said, it's compounded by the sin of lying. He's managed to break two commandments even before the Ten Commandments were issued. That's pretty impressive work for a single day in the fields. But it's not a record I would care to carry with me. So, as a basis of an argument, of course, the argument that is used by people who don't understand the roots is that we have a responsibility for our fellow brother. And that's all well and good, but the question is, are we our brother's keeper? Is not. Let me ask you this question. Can you give me examples of keepers from human history?
You mean like a gamekeeper or a groundskeeper?
No. Or a fisherman. Yeah, I won't buy a fisherman either saying that's a keeper. I'm sorry.
Would a slave master be a keeper?
A slave owner would be indeed a keeper.
Yeah.
And so if Obama is his brother's keeper, is he not advocating a return to slavery? Is it not, to paraphrase the phrase, up from slavery, is he not promoting back to slavery? Yes. I mean, it's right there in his speeches. He wants to go back to, of course, he wants to enslave the productive. And
he wants to be the master.
He wants to be the master, not the slave. But the idea here is, if we started as a nation of keepers, the South, and the North pretty much made it illegal once the colonies became states. But we were a nation of keepers. And to our shame and regret. So why would we want to now recreate slavery in terms of welfare, in terms of hunger, in terms of any issue? It seems to me that the very people who were free now want to be returned to slavery. Any comments on that? Any further thoughts?
Well, I was thinking of Obama's meeting of all these illegals coming to our country right now, too.
Well, actually, that apparently that has slowed tremendously because our economic conditions are so bad that they're going back rather than coming in. But who would have thunk that the solution to the illegal immigration problem was to make the American economy worse than the Mexican economy? But this is like in the weather. High pressure systems move in to low pressure systems. So if there are no jobs for illegals in this country, they all go back to Mexico looking for employment. I'm sure that they can put on their resume now, been to America, learned all kinds of useful skills, please hire me. The whole notion here of being your brother's keeper means what other than slavery? Well, what's another role model for keeping someone?
Well, you're going to be making their decisions for them.
No, I understand that, but what's another social role model that of a keeper?
I'm thinking of a pimp.
There you go. I wasn't going to be quite.
Dorothy, I'm shocked.
Well, I'm sure there's all kinds of pimps that come to the library to read books. So.
I think it's from the books I'm reading. I got that idea.
Oh, okay. All right.
What about jailers?
Well, all right, but that's a case where we're talking about the people like Cain who have transgressed and have been convicted and sent off. Sure, jailers are keepers. There's no question about it. Jailhouse keeper. But I think that's not an example from society. Yes, Rose.
This would not always be the case, but certainly in some families where there would be a domineering mother or father who manipulate and control the family under the guise of family unity.
Sure.
You must do this, you must do that, do as I say.
Now we're getting into a fairly subtle area because, of course, parents are keepers of their children until they become adults.
Well, I'm talking about the negative, the extreme.
Okay. But if you combine that idea with Dorothy's suggestion of a pimp, how about mistresses or gigolos, kept women, or occasionally the kept man? We use the phrase keep to euphemistically refer to setting, you know, we talk about setting her up for as a housekeeper.
It was a part of the culture of Japan.
Well, it's part of the culture of Japan with the geisha, but they weren't, they were paid for, but they weren't kept. They lived.
Your goal
their,
was
yeah.
to have a yeah. sugar daddy.
Right.
That's not what they called them.
Yeah. they call it shula.
I forget what they call it.
To go even more blatant, we have not necessarily more blatant, but it used to be before copyright laws were passed that artists and writers had to find a patron who would, in essence, keep them. I was just reading about Samuel Johnson, who was commissioned to write the first dictionary, real dictionary in the English language. And he received this commission and then went out to find a patron, because that's the way you did it back then. And the patron supported you because your writings were not likely to support you. And he went and talked to this one guy, Lord Cunningham or somebody, who said, oh, he would be delighted to be a patron, and gave him £10, which in those days, in 1745, £10 could last you quite some time, but he had to hire six assistants and to help him with the translation and the assembly and everything, and £10 was just nothing. And near the end, and then afterwards, as he tried to get more money out of his patron, the patron blew him off, until the very end, when it became rumored that the book was almost done and was about to be out there, and he wanted a glowing preface of patronage from submission from Samuel Johnson. And Johnson wrote him back one of the great stinging letters of, oh, I appreciate your patronage, blah, 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 blah. I really appreciate this gesture, but where were you 3 years ago when I needed the damn money? Just cut him down to the quick. And it's considered one of the great pieces of English letter writing. Although, of course, it's not never taught because it's mean-spirited. But so basically, a being a brother, your brother's keeper means an unequal relationship. A relationship of the elite caring for the unprepared. And so out of one side of the mouth, he condemns slavery and apologizes for it. And on the other side of his mouth, he asks for more of it, a return to slavery. Yes.
Well, then why are they trying to get rid of philanthropy?
Well, the reason why they're trying to get rid of philanthropy, anybody know the answer to that?
Well, so they've got...
What?
Yeah.
So they're
trying to get...
I'm sorry?
What was the question again?
The question was, why is Obama trying to get rid of philanthropy?
By taking away the tax deduction.
By taking away the tax deduction. And somebody said something about government, but I don't know who.
Dorothy. Yeah, that would be just so that government can take on the role of deciding.
Exactly. If you give a tax deduction for giving, say, $100,000 to philanthropy, the individual citizen controls the spending of that money. If, on the other hand, you say the government's going to take this over, there will be no further tax deductions for philanthropy, charitable giving, but we'll take care of the problem. We'll give food stamps. You don't need to have food banks, or homeless shelters or anything run privately, we'll do it all. See, then they have ultimate power over the individual. They take away the... This is why the income tax is so pernicious, because it taxes the freedom of individual choice at its source, meaning earning. Whereas the sales tax takes all the power away from the government and the senators and the congressmen, and it gives it back to the individual, because the individual can decide, if I don't want to spend, if I don't want to have pay $25,000 of taxes to the government, I don't have to buy a $100,000 automobile. I can buy a $10,000 automobile, maybe a used one, and pay one-tenth of the tax to the government. So it puts the decisions of how government revenues are going to be raised back in the hands of the individual, out of the hands of legislators, even though it's a tax. It's a fair tax, meaning the government's not involved in it. And that's why it's pretty much a non-starter in Congress until the people ask for it.
So then it's just another lie. He doesn't expect an individual to be his brother's keeper. That's not what he's...
It's the government.
He wants the government to do it.
The government, in the name of all people, will do this regardless of whether you want it to or not.
You know, so why is he asking us, are we our brother's keeper?
Well, it's a rhetorical question. It's a rhetorical question. He asks,
and it's just,
aren't we our brother's keeper? Yes, we are, and therefore we must need these new taxes.
Yeah, I mean, everything he says is twisted.
People are beginning to recognize that. So, getting back to the idea of the brother's keeper. Anybody? Any further comments?
I just see the parallel of Obama to Cain because he's money.
and murdering things too. Killing out that which is good. I think the larger picture here is that it shows a fundamental flaw in his basic assumptions. Apparently, this is one of his... It's hard to tell with Obama, but apparently, this is one of his basic assumptions about government. So it is good to be your brother's keeper. It is Christian to be your brother's keeper. Now, that's bad theology. But nonetheless, he... it has nothing to do with the Christ. It has nothing to do with any genuine religious teachings, but it has entered the thought stream of mass consciousness, and there it is.
Well, I mean, that strips away self-reliance.
Exactly.
And how about minding your own business?
Mind your own business? Yeah, that's a lost principle, too. The yeah?
I was going to say, here's one for Obama. Love your neighbor as yourself.
I don't think Michelle would go along with that. Look, you're asking the impossible. How can he possibly even conceive of loving his neighbor as himself? I mean, his self-esteem is so off the charts at the top that there's no way he could possibly extend that same esteem to others. You're asking for the impossible. Shame on you. All right, one final point. If we are to be our brother's keeper, and as we stipulated about 10 minutes ago, that means an equal relationship, the relationship of a pimp to his whores, relationship of a wealthy man to his mistress, or a wealthy woman to her gigolo. How does that approach the golden mean of friendship as defined by the fellow on the screen, Aristotle? Well, go ahead. Go ahead. Anybody?
Yes, it's totally off balance.
Yes. It doesn't approach the golden mean. It approaches the abyss. And so reasonable thinkers don't fall asleep when they hear this phrase, as Rose indicated most people do. They stand up and, well, the proper response is to laugh and say, what an idiot. Well, anyway, okay. End of discussion. We now go on to our second session of the day, which is, again, our quest for the five stages of literacy. We have talked about literacy in terms of word recognition, literalism. We've talked about reading for meaning, comprehension. We've talked about reading between the lines, allegory. We've talked about reading above the lines, the discovery of the inspiration. Our fifth stage of literacy is to tap the power of what you read. Now, this requires understanding that all ideas have power as well as meaning. And until you implement the power, to apply the idea to your life, you can understand intellectually, but you cannot transform intuitively. So writing, any kind of writing, has the power, if it's good, to awaken realizations within your own thinking to attune you to the power of thought. Now, when Joao Kuhl suggests, through Alice Bailey, that you ponder on this, he is recommending that you brood over certain phrases repeatedly in order to tap the inner power which inspired him. He's not interested in just their meaning. He's interested in tapping the power. And furthermore, when he says, I've been accused of contradicting what I said 3 months ago, in dictating through Alice, but I assure you there's no contradiction at all, he's also, in a sense, highlighting something, a seeming inconsistency. He's highlighting the fact that when you look at it from the level of below the mean, the finite level of life, it appears to be an inconsistency or a paradox, but when you look at it from above the mean, it resolves the paradox. So that's another one of his favorite tricks for getting people to think above the mean. So what degree have you adopted this advice, to ponder on this or to reconcile the seeming inconsistencies? Comments? Can it be taught in school? Can students be suggested that they ponder on this? And how would you describe the activity of pondering, or puddling, as I like to call it? Yeah, I can't put myself in DK's league, so I have to talk about puddling rather than pondering. Now, if we went to the divine level, it would be laking, or maybe oceaning, which of course is another way of saying oceaning would be seeing. That just came through. That was not premeditated. All right, the floor is yours. Yes, pondering.
I think you give them a guided ponder, just as you do for us. You know, by asking kind of the Socratic method, that helps you to ponder.
Okay, I think it's a question of, I think that's very good. Anything else? Sure. Obviously. Yeah. I think just by, first of all, informing children or students that there is the possibility of tapping the power of an idea, and it's done by pondering, just by raising that possibility and giving a few good demonstrations out of Plato or Aristotle or whoever, we'll get them to do it.
Some fairy tales for children.
You could use fairy tales. I think that at that level, you're probably not yet talking about pondering. I'm thinking you need to wait until at least middle school, if not high school, for this. You can sow the seeds. You can always ask them to use their imagination, but until the mental body really starts to take shape, which doesn't occur until, once you've entered adolescence, the mental body starts to take shape, but it isn't fully activated until mid-20s. So from 14 to 28 or so, the mental body is germinating. So there's not much point in doing more than preparing until you get to at least middle school, if not high school.
How about teaching them to work with symbols? Since words, that's what words are.
Okay. However, teaching them to work with symbols is more the stage of reading between the lines, the stage of allegory. And that can then be the basis for saying a symbol can represent meaning and it can represent power. So you have to get them to understand that there is will in ideas. There's volition in ideas. That making a choice between a good idea and a rotten proposal is to unleash the power of the good idea to help you find your way in life.
Well, would it be maybe finding statements or words that people have made? I mean, I know this is on a material level, but to get them the idea of statements or words people have used or made that have affected an action in someone else.
Well, can you give me an example?
That would be I know. Well, you know, I hate to... I don't want to use
Well, that is not, you see, now you got to understand that there's...
That's not what I mean.
Right, that's not what you mean. what you're talking about there is charisma, which does not necessarily tap the power of the idea. It's like this. Martin Luther King developed the idea of nonviolence from Gandhi. Gandhi developed it from Thoreau. So in order to understand nonviolence, you have to go back and understand that the whole concept of civil disobedience, which in Thoreau's case was serving a day in jail rather than paying his tax that supported the war in Mexico. He starts that thesis out with, "I hold with those who say that the best government is that which governs least." Now, Martin Luther King Jr. was not one who stood up and said the best government is one that governs least. He was all for big government. So this is a twist in logic. See? So to tap the power of that idea of civil disobedience, you've got to go back to the source, which is Thoreau. The most misunderstood person in American literature.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to put up the picture in my mind is someone, maybe someone's totally spent, you know, has nothing else to give, you know, and someone says a word to them, and that word suddenly, you can see that person take life. And
sounds like the Nazarene story to me. Nazarudin goes off to the big city and he attends the coronation of the king and comes back to his little village and they say, "How was your trip?" And he said, "Oh, it was wonderful. The king spoke to me." And they say, "Oh, really?" And they're really impressed and they go away and they tell that Nazarudin had an audience with the king. And one fellow stayed behind and said to Nazarudin, "What did the king say?" Nazarudin said, "He said, get out of my way." Now that's the power, you see. That changed his life. All right. Where I'm heading with this is that there are many aspects of literature, which is, of course, written writing that we learn to read that demonstrate the art of penetrating to the core of an idea where its power resides. Poetry condenses ideas into a short poem or a single point from which enlightenment can radiate. Consider this poem from the Poems of Light. It's by me. It's called Synthesis. It's on page 109 of Poems of Light. Every step creates a trace that must be doubled back. Thus from one comes two in hope someday of reaching one again. Lots of friends of mine think the first step easy, the second hard. It's easy for a rock to fall, much harder for the same to fly. But I recall when even rocks found falling tough. The updraft kept on sweeping them away like swiftly swirling snow. Ah, my friends, I've walked a measured line, sometimes leaning to the right, sometimes to the left. And there were days I leaned both ways at once. Last week I found for one brief second I didn't lean at all. I stood in hopeful rhythm and took that second step. So, what's the power? How do you tap the power in that? First of all, what is the power? What does it mean? And how do you tap it? How do you apply it? Keep in mind that the title is synthesis, even though the word never appears in the poem. Well, you can understand that this is, first of all, it's a story of creation. The rocks are material, the elemental forms coming down and then evolving back. This is very much in harmony with Eureka by Poe. But we are moved to the right, we're moved to the left, we lose our balance. And there are days when I lean both ways at once. Last week I found for one brief second I didn't lean at all. I achieved balance. And therefore stood in hopeful rhythm, enabling me to take the next step. So the power here is the power of balance, the power to synthesize your experience and learn from it how to stay on that straight, direct line of righteousness that we talked about yesterday. The power of the word right is directness, the direct line, straight line. Whereas we define what is wrong by falling off of that line. So this gives, if you study this poem and think about it, it gives you the power to achieve balance in your life and understanding that there is this tremendous divine balance that you can harness to maintain stability and recognize the rhythm of life itself. The rhythms of life are imposed by God. It's called the forces of the zodiac. And our job is to harness that rhythm and apply it in our own life. To the degree that we fall to the right or to the left is just our ignorance or our rebelliousness.
So tapping the power is really going to that archetypal energy, which an elevated or enlightened writing represents, or not doesn't represent, but embodies.
Right. Well, that's what poetry and art and music are. It's humanity's greatest geniuses tapping an archetype or something and sharing its meaning to the rest of the world. And if it's a good poem or a good piece of art, it will do that. Here's another example from Aurora Leigh by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. You're familiar with this one, I'm sure. Truly, I reiterate, nothing small, no lily-muffled hum of a summer bee, but find some coupling with the spinning stars. No pebble at your foot but proves a sphere. No chaffinch but implies the cherubim. And glancing on my own thin veined wrist, in such a little tremor of the blood, the whole strong clamor of a vehement soul doth utter itself in distinct. Earth crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and pluck blackberries, and daub their natural faces unaware more and more from the first similitude. How do you ponder on that?
Both of these things that you just read, Carl, to me, I mean, I'm reading this law of economy, but you know, the synthesis, the attraction, and the economy, it's almost the story of our journey, to say the downward and the return, and the awareness.
Sure.
You know, of God is everything.
Yes. Okay, Rose?
So you're talking about basically the microcosm and the macrocosm?
Sure. And what about it?
Well, there's the connection.
Right, okay. So One of the ways this can help children is to learn that everything they learn has a higher context,
yeah.
A higher meaning, a higher power. Good. Any other contributions? Well, this is, as you know, one of my favorite passages in all poetry. Earth's crammed with heaven. You don't have to go above the mean to find heaven. You can find it right here on earth. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. You don't have to go to the top of the mountain. Every common bush is burning with God's love. But only he who sees, you have to have the eyes to see, which Aristotle obviously didn't in that portrait of him. Well, he's looking inward. We can say he's looking inward, therefore he does have the eyes to see.
Right. He's in a trance.
Yes, he's spooked. Only he who sees takes off his shoes, which is a sign of reverence. The rest sit round the bush and pluck blackberries and daub their natural faces unaware more and more from the first similitude. So they see the similarity, they see the parallel, and say, pass me more blackberries. Food, food. So these are examples. Now, Rose has a book called I Never Met a Four I Didn't Like. It's about metaphors and analogies and similes. I Never Met a Four I Didn't Like. One of the entries states, a proverb is anonymous human history compressed to the size of a seed. A proverb is anonymous human history compressed to the size of a seed. So why would I bring that up?
Well, the proverb is a great beginning point for growth. It is compressed to the size of the seed.
Good. And in fact, we have a whole book in the Bible called Proverbs. And we have all kinds of collections of proverbs, some of which are inspired and some of which aren't. Some of them can compress the wrong parts of anonymous human history. By that they mean the experiences, the wisdom gained through human experience that create a seed that then can be planted in your character. And so a stitch in time saves nine means you basically... by anticipating problems and solving them in advance, they never become problems. So proverbs make excellent examples of the principle of pondering, and they're easy. You can work with children with them, and without them ever realizing it, teach them the principle of pondering. What does it mean? How can you apply it to your life? The moment you say, how can you apply that to your life, you've tapped the power of the writing. Here's a proverb from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Thought is the seed of action. Thought is the seed of action. Now, what does he mean by that?
Everything begins with a thought. Everything that's going to be created or done, it all starts with the thought.
Well, let's say everything worthwhile starts with the thought. There are obviously lots of things that have no thought within them, and they are false actions. Panicking because France has there's a rumor that France is going to default, which apparently wasn't true, leads to an action of. That cost the stock market 520 points. There's no seed of action there. There's only rumor and panic and reactiveness. This is very much like the phrase... Oh, go ahead, Rose.
Well, when we have a thought, that actually is a seed planted in our awareness... And if, I mean, if it's just a brief thought, it comes and it goes. But if it's a thought that we continue to think about and to nurture, it does grow and it can become an, and it will become an action.
Okay, we have to distinguish here between feelings, foolish thoughts, and thoughts based on what Plato would call an idea. The things that come and go and never stay are foolish thoughts and emotions.
Okay, but if you think, if you ponder about joy or any of the archetypes, that grows in your awareness and you become to act, you begin to act
right,
in those
right,
ways.
Right.
That's
so,
the action.
So again, you started out by saying if you have a thought. This is one of our great, I know you just were saying that colloquially, but this is where we should recognize that having a thought doesn't make it a seat of action.
Right.
We're supposed to welcome thoughts, genuine thoughts, as a gentle host or hostess who spreads out the whole of the smorgasbord of our mind and character and says, welcome to the feast, take a seat at the table. And we treat it, we protect it, we nourish it. These are all things to which we nurture it so it becomes a seat of action. I compare this to the phrase by Casey, the mind is the builder. Thought is the seat of action. Here's one from Socrates. Virtue is the beauty of the soul. Now what is the power within this proverb? Virtue is the beauty of the soul. Anybody?
Well, I'm interpreting it. I don't know if it's what you want as an answer, but I'm thinking in terms of that the man who lives a virtuous life is reflecting the beauty of spirit, the beauty of the soul.
All right. Anybody else? Well, of course, virtue is divine. Values are what we create at the human level to express virtue. So one thing he's establishing is that this is a quality of the soul. All we can do is aspire to it and replicate it the best we can. But it's the beauty of the soul, not the beauty of the personality. Action is the beauty of the personality. More correctly, right action based on virtue would be the beauty of the personality. Now, not all proverbs fit this billing. Just as many poems miss the mark as well. But Walden Grove will use proverbs, fables, and poetry in throughout, say, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade. Once they know enough about reading to be able to read effectively, we'll use proverbs, fables, and poetry to help students learn to read and learn to read at all levels of literacy, including tapping the power. Here's another example. I mentioned fables. I happen to have a book of fables called The Hourglass. You probably knew that already. Here's a short one called A Funny Thing. Wanting a centerpiece for a table, a farmer's wife went into the woods and picked an assortment of wildflowers. Isn't it strange, one of the flowers remarked after they were arranged in the vase. We've never been together before, yet we complement each other so well. What a coincidence. Now, if you were teaching a Walden Grove class, how would you help students tap the power of that fable? Anybody?
Asking them to ponder what it means and then your basic question, how can to your life.
Okay, but what's the key What's the key focus in this fable?
It seems to me everyone's individual talents and contributions and how they blend together in humanity. So my thought was to have the children decide what they
We lost you.
What about the focusing in on harmony?
Okay, in what sense?
That by understanding your own potential and tapping into or seeing the best in others, you become a more beautiful bouquet.
All right. That would be one idea. Rose?
Well, I think the key word may be complement.
Okay.
How we complement each other. So in any type of group situation, whether it's your family, it's your work, it's your friends, well, maybe not so much your friends because they would tend to be one type, but through a group, you learn to work together and you learn how to complement one another and work the skills and talents to the best advantage of the whole group, the whole enterprise.
Okay, that's part of it, but what's the role of the farmer's wife in all this? Was it a coincidence that she was able to pick flowers and put them together in a vase and make an attractive arrangement? To the flowers, it was a coincidence. It never occurred to the flowers to compliment one another. But having this occur, it did.
Well, so she would almost be like...
Wait a second. Hold on. Yes?
She had a plan with an artistic eye on how the flowers could look beautiful together.
She had a plan and skill and inspiration, yes.
So
yes.
She would represent the soul who picks and chooses our relationships, our situations and circumstances.
Right.
In
she
life.
She could represent the soul, she could represent God, she could represent the one about whom naught can be said.
Mm-hmm.
All these levels of life are working with a plan and a design, and there are no coincidences. Just out-picturing. Our lives are out-picturings of a plan that's already been set in motion. There's no coincidence.
Along with that, Carl, each flower has the uniqueness and individuality that cannot fully be comprehended until it's brought into that collection.
Right, into that bigger picture. You're absolutely right. The other aspect of this is you can make a political comparison. Would this country be the same if there were no liberals or were only conservatives? Would this be the same if there were no blacks or Somalians or Asians or Mexicans or whatever, only people from Great Britain? Yeah.
Well, I mean, part of our identity is the melting pot.
Right, the melting pot is part of our identity. So you can get children talking about very complex ideas at a very early age when education thinks that that's impossible with a simple story like this. Here's another one. Going Places from page 54. A kangaroo found a discarded map. Now I can travel anywhere in the world without losing my way, he exclaimed. Bidding her friends goodbye, she hopped off for parts unknown, the map stashed in her pouch. From time to time, she spread the chart on the ground and selected a point at random with her snout. Oh yes, this is where I am now. The kangaroo continued thus until she was thoroughly lost. Finally, she sat down in despair to puzzle out her predicament. Shortly, a wallaby bounced by. What's wrong? He inquired. I'm lost and can't get home, she heard the befuddled explorer reply. even though I've been following this map every step of the way. Wallabies are always anxious to help. Of course you're lost, he declared with great authority. This map is only good for going places. It doesn't show you how to return. All right. How would you work with students on that one?
Sounds like they're both confused.
Well, what power can you distill from the comment? Sounds like they're both confused. I'm serious.
Oh.
Sounds like a story of the Alpha and the Omega. Or reference to it. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening.
I didn't know if this was working.
It is.
Maybe I'm not working. Does that make any sense?
Well, yes, but I'm waiting for you to explain it and not just guess.
That in order to get any place, you need to know where you've been. And you need to know, it's the idea of a circle where everything comes back to the beginning. That's what I'm trying to get out.
Oh, but she didn't get back to the beginning.
No.
She got lost.
Right.
All right.
She's probably not lost. That's the thing.
Well, she thinks she's lost. She can't find her way home. Anybody?
Well, it doesn't seem like she really had that much of a plan. She discovered a map and just decided to take off and see where it would take her.
She doesn't even know what map it is.
Yeah.
This could be a map that came out of a Cracker Jack box. Just an imaginary map.
So she was just impetuous and took off with no
yes.
no real plan, although she thought she had something that seemed to be a plan or a way to someplace. She really didn't have a clue.
So if you... I'm sorry?
I was thinking of something like that too, setting a goal, pressing forward toward a goal, and not having the willingness to do the work or a sufficient plan to carry it out so that you can come around to your original idea and bring it.
I think the power of this particular fable is don't follow false maps. That there are all kinds of false maps available to people. Any ideology, any theology is a false map. If you follow it, you're going to get lost. You have to follow your own chart, your own inner sense of direction. And she thought this was great because she can go anywhere in the world without losing her way. And the first thing she did the very first day was lose her way. There is no such thing as an accurate map in the physical plane unless you're interpreting it. The Bible can be extraordinarily helpful as a map, so can the Bhagavad Gita and so on, but only if you have the eyes to the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So beware of false maps. Beware of people's ideas leading you astray. Now, at the mental plane, ideas resemble atoms with a nucleus and electrons. You know, the atom has a nucleus composed of neutrons and protons, and they occupy a very dense space right at the center, and then circulating around that nucleus are electrons, which sometimes dart off and combine with another atom and create a molecule. But the power lies in the nucleus, at the hub, in the proton. The key to tapping this power lies in penetrating to the meaning and purpose. purpose is the equivalent of the proton, meaning is the equivalent of the neutron. The electron is our outer expression. And so we have to understand that ideas have great power, but only if we go penetrate, if we're able to penetrate to the core, to the hub, to the center, to their origin. So let's sum up this whole exercise by asking, what ideas have had the greatest impact in your life? Not events, not beliefs, but what ideas have had the greatest impact in your life?
Well, one idea which goes back nearly 40 years when I took the basic was the idea of reincarnation.
Okay.
And I mean, I didn't like that idea, was my emotional response. I didn't really like the idea of that. But as you worked, as I worked with the idea or thought about it, you know, put it on the shelf and, well, yeah, right, sure. I'll just not think about this for a while. I mean, it changes everything.
Okay.
It absolutely changes everything.
All right. So that's one example.
I didn't hear what Rose said, though.
She was talking about the idea of reincarnation. Any other examples of ideas having a great impact in your life?
No.
Yes. Okay, the power of love or goodwill to forgive. Great, good example. Any others? Uh-huh. Anyone else? Yeah, as bad as mass consciousness is in this country, it's 10 times worse right now in England. And in any event, other examples of ideas that had great impact on your life.
I'm thinking of energy follows attention.
I'm sorry, I didn't pay attention. No, that's a good example. Anybody else? A Rose?
Oh, this was just also from a book I read after taking the basic the first time, was The Thought Forms.
Uh-huh.
And the idea that thoughts are real.
Mm-hmm.
That was just a totally new idea to me.
Well, thoughts are objective. They're not exactly real, but they're objective.
The way it was explained in there was just a totally new understanding for me.
Okay. Well, these are good examples, and this is why, I mean, ideas have the power to completely change the course and direction of your life and actions. They have the power to change the course and trends of human history and current affairs. Good. Okay, that's the end of that session. We're going to have a break here. It's recess time. Let's be back at 10:30, ready to roll.